Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens.
And my name is Kathleen McGowan. And today we have a very, very special guest on a subject that is so interesting and so topical and so important in our world right now. We're going to talk about the subject of star seeds, about our connection to the stars, and about all of the things that entails. And it's such a broad subject because it entails all kinds of extraordinary things, things like synchronicity, things like the way we're all being guided at this extraordinary period in time. This is going to be a very magical and very fascinating hour. So I really recommend that you turn this up and pay close attention and also have fun because our guest is an extraordinary woman who we call Lavendar. She is a galactic shaman. She is a master astrologer. She was a close friend of Linda Goodman, which is how we became in contact with each other and now have become great friends. And we will talk about all of those things. But she is, I think, most well known as the founder of the Starseed Academy and the Starseed Hotline. So I want to welcome Lavendar to the show with my first question, which is, Lavendar, can you talk about what this idea of a starseed is and how you came to walk this path?
Well, thank you so much, Kathleen. It is my privilege to be here to talk about the wonderful world of starseeds. First, I'd like to just say that there's a definition that I wrote that I would like to read. Starseed, souls having lived or originated on other planets, other galaxies, on spacecraft, or in other dimensions and interlocking world spaces, who have volunteered to assist in bringing in the new age of reason and assist Earth through the next evolution. They inhabit their human body from its birth. Some are born knowing this. Others are to be activated or wake up at a later time. The timing of the moment of birth is deliberate. Souls agreeing to come to Earth together find corresponding genetics that fit their soul's mission. A lot of experiments have been put in motion through bloodlines just for this purpose in order to house the starseed operations. There are many variations of these experiments with starseed, as there are many combinations of astrological star codings through planet placement, blood and genetic requirements to match galactic agendas. One may have astrological markings through starseed codes, but without the bloodline to enhance the markings, it gets more difficult for a starseed to resonate to a galactic agenda. Starseeds are programmed, so to speak, to aid in the activation of their brothers and sisters in collective advancement through moral, ethical, and mental spiritual guidance. When starseeds are called upon to gather in unison of purpose, that is when others seem to witness miracles or magic in motion because of their combined galactic heritage. Most starseeds that are truly activated from all levels seem to hold their optimism about the missions that they have chosen. Another trait of starseed is to totally rejuvenate their bodies through meditation or other modes of healing. Others not yet activated into their knowing can and do turn sometimes to darker agendas of behavior. But true power of starseed comes from knowing their total journey. There seems to be a constant among starseed, and that is that a guidance system seems to oversee their stay on Earth and assist when truly needed. And that's my basic definition of starseed.
Well, and Lavendar, when I first became aware of your work, one of the things that I was really overwhelmed by is how many people have been called to it. I mean, you have a large and expanding global network of people who are feeling really called to that definition on so many levels. And we'll take that apart a little bit about what that means. We'll take apart a little bit about what the bloodline means to you, because you've told me some extremely interesting stories about this idea of a bloodline. You know, a lot of my listeners know that when I talk about the bloodline, we talk about the bloodline of Jesus and Mary Magdalene, and also that bloodline goes even further back, that it is a bloodline that goes back to many, many other ancient places. But I would like to talk about that with you a little bit. Can you talk about the Atlantis connection and what this bloodline idea is, to clarify it for our listeners who are going to be new to the point of view that you bring to it?
Okay. Well, let's start with the Pleiades. When Atlantis was flourishing, and it was a Pleiadian seeding. It's like a lot of Pleiadians came down and were very, very involved in the history of Atlantis. And in fact, Atlantis went down and was reconstructed three different times. But the very, very last time that we had Atlantis, which is about over 12,000 years ago, one of the gigantic council meetings that came together from the Pleiades called in other assistant beings from other places, the Andromedans, the Arcturians, and they said, you know, we've got to set up something through a bloodline, through a nanotechnology, through a bloodline that's going to, if something really, really bad happens to Atlantis, that we have a backup plan so that this will never happen again. And so it was actually put in motion from the Pleiades in a gigantic council meeting with the Crystal Brotherhood. A lot of beings were involved in it. And this is like something right out of Star Trek, I know. But this is basically what happened, is that when the time came for Atlantis to be destroyed, and when the call came out that for those to leave and to go to other places, it did happen that way. Some were given guidance to go with tablets. Some were taken with crystals. Some were all kinds of forms of information was given to these beings to go to the four corners of the earth, to plant them, to bury them, where they would be discovered many, many, many thousands of years later. But the one thing they did, the one thing that was constant, and it had universal code in it. Universal code meant so many of the other species would have access to this code. This code would be a nanotechnology placed in a bloodline and would have the markings of astrological timing. It would have the bloodlines of those that came from the Pleiades that were overseeing this. There was a long list. I'm just mentioning a couple of them, because when I was actually shown the different codes that went in there, I had to go lay down for 3 days. I couldn't even handle or process, because my little brain just went, whoops. I'm not mathematically inclined anyway. In fact, I wanted to bring up that when the 12 time zone programs hit the planet, I don't know how we ever got on the 10 system where everything is done by tens, you know, like $100, $200, whatever. It's like one of the reasons I think I had so much trouble in school is because I came here on a 12 time system. Everything is 12s to me, or combinations of 12s. So that was just a little sideline. But anyway, I just wanted to go back to the most intricate part of the tracking has to do with the technology that was placed in the DNA, in the bloodline, which matches my discovery of star markings, which is 25, 26, or 27 degrees of any sign. That's kind of the key that unlocks the programming that I've been tracking, is when I find these astrological markings, it unlocks the universal library for me to go and track it. Now, we can go back to how I was put together and what I carry in my body. I have technologies in my body that tracks these kinds of things. So, anyway, there you have it.
Was it your work as an astrologer that first brought you to this? Was it astrology? You have an amazing background, and I want to talk about how you got here. And ultimately, I want to ask you some questions about George Van Tassel and your work with him and all of that. But let's start from the beginning. I mean, how did Lavendar end up on this path? Where did this begin for you?
Well, it actually came with my conception. My mother told me that she'd been trying to get pregnant for 7 years, and that on a particular night, there was a blue light that came into the room where she and my father were in having sex, and after that blue light came in, she said that she got pregnant, and that that's what she told me. And for years, I didn't really know what that meant. Later on, I thought, you know what, this all started because I was aboard ship going, you know what, this is how I want it to be. It's like, I believe that I planned my birth. I believe I planned everything that I had been involved in. So that was the beginning. And it's through my childhood, I had abilities that other children didn't have. I was an only child. And what was so strange about my birth is that my father was sterile. And, of course, that was such a hush-hush thing throughout my years growing up with the grandparents, because they wouldn't even put my picture up. They thought that possibly the man down the road was my father. So that's kind of how it started. Years later, many, 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 many years later, when I was really into tracking so many, I can't tell you how many women I have met that have this same story. You know, at first it was like, ooh, a star in the east. No, but now I understand that it's really part of a genetic experiment that happens on the planet. So I know it sounds kind of strange to
hear. You know, I wanted to stop you there just for a second, because when I started doing my research, when I was writing about Immaculate Conception, and what the Book of Love actually says about Immaculate Conception, what the earliest Gnostic Christians and the Cathars said about Immaculate Conception, I began to find case upon case upon case upon case of stories similar to yours, where women had conceived, quote, immaculately, in that there was no explanation in terms of the male aspect of the donation to the conception. I mean, ultimately, what I was researching was this idea that, you know, children conceived in a place of trust and consciousness are all immaculate, which was what I was writing about. But as I went off to investigate that, what I came upon was hundreds, maybe even thousands of cases where the traditional sort of star in the east immaculate conception happened over and over again. So what is your thought on that? Because you said it's part of an experimentation. How do you feel about that overall?
I'm so glad that you discovered that and you just spoke about it so eloquently. What I've really come to know is that they're kind of the blue bloods of the experiments. When these women have these kind of conceptions, you know, when they have these babies, that really launches an entirely new group of evolved souls carrying the genetics, the bloodlines, and consciousness. It's about consciousness and the evolution of consciousness. I was thinking this morning about, you know, I'm up there in years, and it's like, wow, how many others were the first waivers? Then there's the second waivers, then the third waivers. It's like we all have a group in a wave to bring consciousness to the planet. And it's like what was given to me back in 1977 with George Van Tassel, it's like, you go put this in the vault and you sit on it until we tell you to bring it out. And I said, well, how long do you think that is? And they go, well, about 25 years. And I went, what? You want me, this Sagittarius mouth, to stay shut for 25 years? Are you giving me the test of my life? They said, yeah. I said, okay. And so it was all designed for me to have these experiences. I had to walk the journey, had to write it down, had to journal it, put it in the vault, and keep my mouth shut to the masses. Now, I did have an inner circle that always knew what I was doing, and they have been my witnesses to my work. So I forgot what the original question was. I kind of went off on a tangent. You kind of have to watch me do that.
No, I was just asking you about the idea of Immaculate Conception and what kind of an experiment that could have been. And you were talking about how these children are extraordinary.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, and how they launch either genius on the planet or how they launch a particular bloodline that holds a real high creative spin that you know, really brings the planet to another place. And when they collectively get together, and that's kind of what I'm seeing happening now. I'm seeing these little pockets of soul groups that are starting to emerge. And because of the technology on the planet, you know, the phones and the faxes, and then we went to the internet and to the blogging, and now it's like Skype, and it's like, whoa, now it's about finding the soul groups. So you ask about when did this start. Okay, so we have soul groups from Atlantis. There was a group of souls that said, never again Atlantis. Then later on, their little pockets in France started rising up, the Cathars. And when we looked at their records, it was like, ooh, a lot of old Atlanteans are now Cathars. And now the Cathars are saying, never again. In fact, they came together in such a conscious mode as to bring the moment of their death. A lot of them sealed their contracts with each other where they come back at a later time and would rise up and bring the truth about what was happening with Christianity, with Jesus, Mary Magdalene, and everything that you've written about, Kathleen.
Well, and there is, you know, there are Cathar prophecies, the prophecy that the laurel will turn green again in 700 years. And there are a number of different legends around the Cathars that they prophesied that they would come back at a later time when the world was more ready for the message. And certainly Philip and I have been extremely blessed and overwhelmed by what we have witnessed in France over these last couple of years. And most specifically, when we started doing these Sacred France journeys last year in 2011, every group that came was extraordinary. And you could watch these soul groups reuniting there. And we had no idea when we set out to do this. We knew that we wanted to share our France with like-minded souls and spirits who are called to it, because we knew that it was transformational and extraordinary. What we didn't realize consciously when we first started creating these Sacred France journeys is that we were putting out a kind of call to these soul families, spirit families, as we have called them, to reunite and come back to this place. But, you know, we found that when we would spend time with these people over a week, that by the time we were all separated, it was hard. It was like your family going off to another place. So we are definitely watching this happen. And I feel like it's happening much, much faster in this accelerated pace now. Is that how you feel?
Yes, absolutely. It's like, you know, like the moment before you and I talked on the phone, it's like I was anticipating our conversation to the point of, it's like I was like a racehorse, you know, in the gate ready to come out. But I knew that when I came out that it wasn't going to be a sprint race. It was going to be one of those long races. It was going to be a 2-miler, you know, or something. It's like, whoa, once I go through this door, you know, I won't ever be able to go back. I got to just get really steady. This is one of the things that I've been holding on to in the vault for all these years. And so when we timed our phone conversation, and I waited till Mercury was direct, that was real important to me. Anyway, I felt like that it was the opening of not only taking my discovery of star markings, but it was the opening of all these soul families that had been contacting me, and I had gone into like discovery of star markings part 2, because it all started with a group out of Ohio, a group of women, and I started seeing the Cathar and the France markings in their charts, and then I tracked them back to Atlantis, and then I weaved them back to France again, and I went, oh my goodness, what is going on here? So the further I got into this, then all of a sudden it looked like that some magnetic calling started happening. People that started listening to our radio show then started ordering their charts, and then I started growing with this group. I have over 400 charts that I would say maybe, I don't know how many of them don't have the markings, but maybe 5 or 6. But out of that group, everybody's got the markings. And it's like, okay, how did that happen? How did all these people wake up one day and say, I want my astrological chart done to see if I have these star markings? And it's happening. Just like the trip that we're planning now with you. It's like, you know, people are saying, I've got to be on that trip. My name is on it.
Now, let's backtrack to something you were talking about a bit earlier, which is that for you it started in 1977 with George Van Tassel. George Van Tassel, to some of our listeners, might be famous as one of the bigger names in what people now describe as UFO contactees. So what was your experience with George? What kind of mission or joint mission or whatever you want to call it did you start in 1977?
Okay, 1977, I was living in Las Vegas, and I was one of those, you know, really pioneer type people wanting to explore and do all kinds of new and different things. I've always had my hand up for being bizarre and different. So when my friend Belva said, let's go meet George Van Tassel, I said, oh yeah, I want to do that. And so we went down to Giant Rock and I met him. And I went down on several occasions, and he took a really strong liking to me. And so on one particular occasion, he called me and said, look, you need to come down. I have just been given some scrolls. And, I really think, that Harvey the healer should come with you. And so we got on an airplane and we went down to Giant Rock. And so in 1977, we came together with another couple, Ruben and his wife, I can't remember her name now, and we sat around and we started reading scrolls. These scrolls were called the Wadi Scrolls, and they had been deciphered in Stanford University for 7 years, translated into English, and a man named Leo had given them to George because Leo had a stroke. And he gave them to George. He said, look, you need these scrolls, and you need to find people that are responsible for this information. So we sat around and we started reading, and what was in the scrolls was the fact that Jesus did not die on the cross as we had been told. There were letters from Claudius and Pontius Pilate and Nicodemus and all kinds of characters had written letters, and they were in the scrolls. And of course, me being brought up a Baptist, you know, I was in shock right away. There were some things that I held sacred, and I thought, oh my goodness, this is, you know, this is 1977, and I was in shock. But I was also very aware that I was being placed to hear this material. So what would happen is we'd read, and we'd take little breaks, and then we'd start reading again, and then in the middle of the night, this huge light came down. And a blue light, and it just flooded where we were. We're all trying to sleep. And I guess we had some missing time. I'm not sure. But the next day, when we get up to finish reading the scrolls, there's a knock on the door, and it's Leo. And he's in a wheelchair, and the nurse has brought him. And he said, I was awakened in the middle of the night, and I was told to come here, that you were gathered and reading the scrolls, and I had to be here. And so he came in, and I said, wow, that was synchronized. Then there was another knock on the door in just a few minutes, and here stands this tall Aussie. He said, hi, my name is Donovan Joyce, and I have written a book called The Jesus Scrolls. I looked down right there by the door, and there was his book. Because Doris, George's wife, had received it the week before. And I thought, synchronization, oh, goodness, look at that. So he came in, and so we started reading the scrolls again. Well, after we finished reading the scrolls, George says to me, why don't we just take a walk through the sand dunes? Because there are a lot of sand dunes around this area. And George had also had lived underneath this giant rock there at one time. And so we walked where we could see it, and he started talking to me, and all of a sudden he said, see that rock over there? He said, one day it's going to crack, and when it cracks, you're going to release some information. I said, oh, what are you talking about? And all of a sudden he turns, and he looks at me, and his eyes just kind of changed, and there was this download that happened. And this went on for 3 hours. He would just tell me things. He told me about rejuvenation and why he was building the Integraton. And then he told me about ETs and time travel and remote viewing and walk-ins and everything that we know about now. I was hearing about 1977. So when all this was said and done over 3 hour period, he turns to me and he says, okay, it's time for you to go back now. And I just wheeled around and walked back. And he said, oh, I'll see you later. And so I went back, and a few hours later, Doris goes, where's George? And I said, well, he said he's coming back. And I had gone in and taken a nap, and actually I'd been back 3 or 4 hours, and he was missing. Then everybody went out and looked for George. No one could find him. And, oh, I don't know, midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning, he comes strolling in like nothing had happened. He winks at me. And then he goes over and touches everybody on their forehead, and no one had any memory of him even be missing. Now, he had told me about Watkins. All of a sudden, I knew that the original George wasn't there, and I was dealing with somebody new, and he was able to show me that. And that's my basic story about George Van Tassel.
And what about the cracking of the rock, for those who don't know the story? He told you that this big rock would crack. And...
Yeah, he said one day the rock will crack. So in, believe it was in February 23rd, I think, 1999 or year 2000. I don't have my dates in front of me. But lightning hit and cracked the rock. And I was here in Oklahoma. And I was taking care of my mother and father, who were ill, and she was in a wheelchair. And for some reason, I had said, let's take your paintings out, and let's put your name on them. And I pulled one out of sand dunes, and I said something about, oh, you know what, I'll paint George and me in the sand dunes. And she turns around and says, when are you going to finish your story? Well, I'd never even told my mother about George Van Tassel, so I have no idea why she even said that. That was the day that lightning hit the rock, was the day she said this. So well, it was like synchronized, you know, event somehow.
Right, and we're going to talk about synchronicity in a minute. For our listeners who want to have some more information about George Van Tassel, he was the creator of an extraordinary structure called the Integratron, which we'll definitely talk about in the future. In fact, I'd like to get the current ladies who are the caretakers of the Integratron on the show and talk a little bit about George's legacy with them. But we will post some information about George on our website so that you can go to the Integratron website and take a look at the extraordinary work that George was doing and the information he was getting. George's information about being a contactee was for me the most compelling I've ever heard. It was really, you know, before I had heard the George Van Tassel story, I was kind of skeptical about all of this, you know, about all the UFO stuff and this whole idea of contactees. I was like, eh, maybe. And then being a native of Southern California, had heard a lot about the Integratron. And then finally, when I got myself out there a couple of years ago, I was completely blown away by what George created out there in the desert. And all of the stories that he had and the information that he had was quite extraordinary.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, when he died such a month later after this, you know, the walk-in came in, then I got a call from Doris telling me that George had just died in a motel in Santa Ana, and could I come quickly? And she said a blue light came in and exploded the lamp and the table, and that he was gone. So when I got there, she said, yeah. She said, but you know what? When the George I knew left the day that you took a walk with him. And she knew that, and she confirmed it for me. And I went about putting together his memorial and all of the arrangements. Doris was in no shape to do that. But years later, I had a very extraordinary experience with George when I was in Oak Creek Canyon driving, trying to find a place to rent so I could sit down and write. And there he was standing beside the road pointing at this cabin. And there was a sign. It was a motel sign, but it was closed. And he pointed, and all of a sudden I screamed. I said, stop the car. That's George. Turn around. And went back, and of course he wasn't standing there anymore. But where he was pointing, I said, you know, we got to find who owns this motel that's closed. And sure enough, the people that owned it were in Cripple Creek, that ran the Red Lantern there that I'd eaten at so many times. And I told him, I said, I need to rent your cabin. And they rendered it to me, and I had it for 3 months, and it was during those 3 months that was so much was revealed to me. So it was like, okay, he just holographically, you know, manufactured himself, or someone did, to point the way to where I was going to write more and put more in the vault.
Now, okay, so let's talk about Cripple Creek, Colorado, because you found yourself in Cripple Creek, Colorado, in the presence of someone who I think has brought us together in her own inimitable way, and that is the late, great Linda Goodman. Tell us a little bit about how you ended up in Cripple Creek, first of all, what brought you there, and then how you and Linda became friends.
Wow. How did I get to Cripple Creek? There was just a time when I was just led to go to places and just be there. And when I got to Cripple Creek, I knew that I needed to find a place to live and to be there. So, my friend Belva, she was also drawn there, and she lived in Las Vegas also. And so I found this place in town. But when she said, oh, let me have that house. You can't handle that train that's going to blow its whistle all the time. You better find another place. So I went out and found another place. And I found an A-frame cabin. And I didn't know it then, but I actually found the place where Nikola Tesla caught lightning in a jar. And that's a whole nother story. But anyway, I was about, I guess 3 miles out from Cripple Creek. So I knew that Linda Goodman was there, and so I went and introduced myself, and we became very, very close friends. And we had a coffee meeting once a week, and we did this for 7 years. This is part of the synchronization that I was talking to you about earlier today, and that is I'd walk in the door with a bottle of brandy, and she would say, when are you going to help me with the scrolls? And I'd say, I'm not. And I'd say, when are you going to help me with discovery of star markings? And she'd say, I'm not. And I'd walk in and pour brandy in our coffee, and that would, and then we just had a real good time. And this went on, and it was like when I hit the door, these were words I had to say. I'm not, I'm not. She'd say, I'm not, I'm saying I'm not. It's like, it got to be, in fact, it was like there was just some kind of little signal that we had to say this. So when I got ready to leave Cripple Creek, I went and gave her a copy of the Emerald Tablets. So when I read your book, and it's like 3 o'clock in the morning, and I at the very end where you have the acknowledgments, I'd just like to read this one paragraph, because this is what really had my hair standing on end. I also owe a debt to the illustrious Ram Queen Linda Goodman, the late astrologer and author who first whispered this secret into my ear long before I was ready to comprehend it. She altered the course of my life with that piece of information and by leaving me her Emerald Tablet translations, which will show their importance in later books. My destiny remains strangely intertwined with Linda's, a fact that has brought both surprising pain but also great joy. I wish she had stayed with us long enough to see the proof I uncovered of her own bloodline connections. And so this morning, her face kind of came to me, and it was like synchronization is confirmation. And I thought, yes, we probably need to tell this story about Linda Goodman and how all this came together, because it shows how far in advance all this was planned.
Well, and that's a piece of it for me that is astonishing and amazing and literally wonderful. You know, that when I stand back and try to comprehend the amount of effort and divine intelligence that has to go into weaving this extraordinary tapestry that is the life we're all living together here in 2012, it's just absolutely astonishing. I mean, so here we have, you know, me being given a copy of Linda's Emerald Tablet translations after she dies. She dies October 21st, 1995. Through a series of amazingly synchronistic events, I am contacted by a woman who she had entrusted her translations to and told her to find someone who fit my description. And ultimately, we were able to confirm through a lot of ways, which is too long of a story to tell here. I will write it out because it's such an amazing story. You know, she, anyway, it was clear that the tablets were supposed to come to me, based on the fact that Linda and I had worked together on something in 1993, and, you know, we had had these discussions. And so, you know, here I was with these cherished Emerald Tablet translations, with Linda's little notes in the markings, in the margins where she had written certain things as she was reading them. And those translations, really, really opened my mind and my eyes and my soul and my spirit in so many ways. There's some extraordinary information in them. And when I wrote The Expected One and I wrote the very, very long author's notes and acknowledgments, I just knew I had to include all of that information. I knew that the author's notes and the acknowledgments of that book were so important because they were a call to other people out there who I knew would recognize some of these stories and come to them. And when I wrote that paragraph about Linda Goodman, I knew I was writing it for someone. I just didn't know what. I just knew I had to put it out there. So for you to then pick up the book those years later and read it and read that I had the Emerald Tablet translations, which you had given to Linda, and we had come full circle, I could tell this story every day and not, you know, not ever be any less amazed by the wonder of it all.
Well, and the thing that kept, you know, nagging at me every time I'd walk in the door is that I knew my name wasn't on the scrolls yet. I mean, I thought at the time they never would be, but I was so emphatic about saying no, you see.
Well, also, I want to clarify that she also said to you, because you didn't say this today on the show, but you have said this to me, that she said to you, she often referred to them as the Mary Magdalene scrolls, isn't
yes.
that right?
Yes, Mary Magdalene scrolls. Mary Magdalene scrolls, absolutely. Yes.
And this is the other thing that I found completely astonishing is that, you know, she would ask you every week, do you want to talk to me? You want to help me with these Mary Magdalene scrolls? And you said no, because you weren't ready to. But that she was bringing this up every week. And in the conversation that I had with her back in the early 90s, when she first talked to me about Mary Magdalene, she kept saying, you know, there is so much more to this story, you know, that needs to get out. And that was when she told me after doing my chart, you know, this story about Mary Magdalene, and who she was and why she matters is part of your destiny. And this whole idea of twin souls and how all this works together, this is something that you're going to have to step into at some stage because it's what you're here to do. You know, that's the secret that she whispered in my ear back then. And I, of course, had no idea what she was talking about at that stage. But, you know, to me, then it goes back to you ultimately, you know, years after Linda's passing, or at least years after your, you know, the years that you spent with her, you step into this idea of really having to understand the importance of Mary Magdalene in this story as well. So, you know, Linda was activating something, I think, in both of our consciousnesses or subconsciousnesses. Do you agree?
Absolutely. But here's where I track from. The extraterrestrials that had me lined up with nanotechnology, they were like pulling my strings. I mean, I just know that they, you know, had me on board with saying that because I was stuck on discovery of star. I was starting to discover these markings, and they ran me through a 3-year maze of, you know, where I wouldn't miss it, which is a long involved story that I won't go into right now. In fact, it is on our website. If you go to www.starseedhotline.com and look in our vault of knowledge, you'll find the story called Discovery of Star Markings. They were so emphatic about me staying with Discovery of Star Markings that I became emphatic. So every time she'd bring up the Mary Magdalene scrolls, you know, I'd just say no. But, oh yeah. But it was part of it. It was part of, see, my name wasn't on it yet. It's like I've come to know what my name is on and what my name is not on. And a lot of people that come to me now as clients, you know, they'll say, well, what's my name on? And through an astrological chart, I'll give them choices and say, here's your rites of passage. Here's your natural state. You choose. And that's how I work with it. But yeah, I think it's synchronization is confirmation. And I feel like that when I read that paragraph and then I flipped the book over, saw your picture, I went, destiny, we are to meet, we are to work. I get it now. I don't get all of it, but I knew that our meeting would take place. I didn't know when, I didn't know how. I just knew that it would. And as a result of that, I had to probably find all 400 of these people through their charts before you and I could ever have a conversation.
Well, and I find it extremely interesting that you were saying at the beginning about the awakening. You know, you're either born with this information or you awake to the information in your lifetime. And that is precisely some of the main messages of the Hermetic doctrine, which, you know, you gave to Linda and Linda gave to Kathleen. And this is something which sits within the tradition. These documents are said to be timeless, you know, preserved, recodified in ancient Egypt, but stemming from, so to speak, the dawn of time. This is the primordial wisdom given to mankind.
Absolutely. It's all, you know, it is a tapestry. It is the weaving of a story that brings everything into oneness and to show how all the different connecting dots and pieces flow together with creation. And it shows the polarity dance on the planet. It shows, you know, how everything was put in motion through the 12 time zones. And the 12 time zones, of course, we mark them with 12 astrological signs. And that is it's a blueprint. In fact, sometimes when I look at a chart, I'll say, oh, this is your personal crop circle, because it is. It's like an energy stamp. It's an energy stamp on the soul. It shows me a pattern, and I look at it, and then all of a sudden I start tracking really quickly, you know, through this particular modality, the star seeds in a person's chart. And then I just keep going and going. And sometimes, you know, this filly has to pull up. It's like, you know, there are times when I have to go, you know what, I can't track another thing because my little brain just going to go zip. And I'll have to go lay down for a few days after that. So, but it's exciting. And the reason that I keep doing it is because the next day always brings another starseed code and I find another opening to this story. And it's hard not to want to see what's going to happen the next day. But there's times when I go, you know what? I've had enough for now. Did you have that experience, Kathleen, when you were on such a roll that you just had to stop yourself sometimes?
Absolutely. You know, I still do. Because there are times when it's just overwhelming.
You know, I know.
There are times when there's so much information coming at you all at once that, you know, it's funny because I even say the same things. You know what? My little brain just can't handle anymore right now, you know. And there are times when I don't sleep a lot. I mean, first of all, I'm one of those people who I haven't slept through the night since sometime in the 90s because things wake me up all the time and I'm not good at turning off my brain. So I go through, you know, I'll go through years, you know, where I'm not sleeping, you know, pretty much at all. And then all of a sudden something will happen and I'll just be so overwhelmed by everything that's being thrown at me that I just have to go to bed and like lie down for a couple of days. And I think you just have to allow yourself to regenerate sometimes and rejuvenate. And there's also, I think that there's a certain feeling of responsibility when you feel like you're being given a lot of information. You know, for me, it's like, okay, well, what do I do with all this information? How do I present this information responsibly? How do I best use the information that I've been given, or shown, or that I've discovered in my research? Because there's all these different ways that I get my research and my information. Some of it's academic, some of it's spiritual. And how do I, you know, so for me, it's sometimes overwhelming to determine what do I do with it all and how do I use it all? Because, you know, at the end of the day, we are human and we are trying to sort of process some of this. Some of this is, you know, it's literally metaphysical. It's beyond physical. It's literally supernatural. It's beyond the natural. And, you know, I also, like you, you know, we have so many things in common in that we both had unusual childhoods and you know, I was raised in a very open environment. So I was raised in a very psychic environment. I never had any blocks, which is the good news and the bad news. You know, the good news is all, you know, things come to me very freely. you know, the bad news is most people don't feel the same way or have the same experience. So for a lot of people, it's very hard to accept some of this information when it comes through psychically or spiritually. So for me, a lot of the exhaustion is, how do I present this information in such a way that it doesn't feel fringy or people are able to deal with it? Which is, you know, one of the things that I have found to be my great gift is fiction, because I have found if I could tell people in story form the information that I'm discovering, then that would be an easier way for them to ingest it. What I love about you is that you are right out there with it. You don't seem to have any qualms or any fears about what anyone thinks. It's like what they, you know, you are so honest about standing up and saying, this is the information that I have and this is what I have to tell. I mean, has that been scary for you?
Not scary, but it took me a while to figure out what I could say and not say to people. It's like, you know, the sag mouth is like a torn pocket. So there were times when I just wanted to just tell everything I knew about what was happening. And then I'd have to go into, oops, I probably shouldn't have said that to the Baptist preacher. but here's the thing about what you just said. I'm a galactic navigator, but then so are you. You're a galactic navigator. But you have taken it to where you are writing in a way that when people read your words, they're looking through your eyes and you're giving them codes. The codes come in phrases and they come in colors and they come through the way you describe art and temples and cathedrals and the labyrinth. And when you start connecting all those things, then all the little lights go off in the reader. And then they become a galactic tracker also. That's kind of how I see it.
Yeah, I mean, that's beautiful, and thank you. Specifically with the Book of Love, I was very much aware that I was writing encoded messages. But with the Expected One, I kind of fell into it. With the Expected One, I don't think I realized I was doing it until it was over. And then as I was sharing it with other people and I was watching the responses and I was watching the awakenings that were happening as people read the book, I went, uh-oh, I'm onto something here. I'm onto something here that is much bigger than I thought. And I realized that I was, you know, I had been a conduit for it. You know, I was strictly the scribe, you know, I'm very blessed to be the person who is able to put that on the page. But I can't take 100% credit for it.
Well, I just loved all three of them. Just for a moment, let's have a Star Trek moment. You're aboard ship. Everybody's aboard ship and saying, okay, we need to have a group consciousness. You be the scribe. You be the painter. You the artist. You take music. Everybody had a job. And they said, okay, we're going to dive down now. And we're going to incarnate through bloodlines. And we're going to weave the story over a period of time. And I really feel like, Kathleen, that you have had the assignment to do so many different things through so many different lifetimes, where you are a collective of all of them, artist, musician, scribe. But in this lifetime, you knew that the written word would be able to go into picture form. And that's why I think that you wrote The Expected One.
And, I mean, taking it back to you, Lavendar, one of the things which you're saying is that this coding happens through astrology, one of the great sciences for thousands of years. When you started out, did you start out as an astrologer, and was this easy for you, or did you really were pushed in it because you realized you had to become an astrologer?
Well, when I became my fiance died on my wedding day, and I was drunk for about 2 years. And coming out of that that stupor, I wound up in California, and I studied with Dana Marshall at the Academy of Atlantis, and I studied Atlantean astrology. And so I was just kind of on a quest. I wanted to find out where my Jim had gone. Well, you know, I thought, if there's life after death, then I'm going to find out where he was. And that's how I went on the quest to find out what happened to him. Okay. So that's how astrology came about. But through the years, and I became an astrologer, and I went to Las Vegas, and I set up a practice, and I had some very exciting clients, and really just started learning about extraterrestrials and George Van Tassel, and it all just kind of started dovetailing into one another. When I discovered this galactic system was in 1980 when I first started tracking it. And like I said, that's a very long story, and it's on our website, starseedhotline.com, and under the Vault of Knowledge. But when I started weaving the galactic codes with the other information, I knew that somehow it was connected to a nanotechnology that was hiding in the bloodlines, having to do with a resonant frequency of a harmonic that was an energy stamp that once it ever got loose and got activated, it was going to start activating soul groups.
And you think that's happened over time, or
in different
eras? So, for example, during the period when we've seen, societies and clusters of very enlightened people, whether it's Atlantis or the Cathar traditions, that you think that's when the activations have happened,
right?
And they're happening now.
Right. And these star dates happen anywhere from the 15th to the 20th of the month. But I really focus on the 25, 26, 27 degrees of any sign. Those are the star markings in astrology. Now, I have discovered others, which I'm still in the process of, researching, and I haven't really put out the other star markings that I've been tracking. But the thing that got me the most was it really pinpointed the genius in a chart. I was in Florida. I was on the phone. I was sending a 80-page fax about the Nobel Peace Prize winners. And on the phone rang, and it says, "You're invited to hear Roy Tate talk about genius in astrology." I went to the meeting. I saw his charts. I went home with him. I said, "Oh, let me see." And I stayed up all night. And here's what I found of the Nobel Peace Prize winners. They were born with the markings. They received the markings when they got the Nobel Prize, and they died with the markings, 95% of them. I went back up and laid down and looked at the ceiling for 3 days. But where are we today? We have the technology on the planet to start getting the word out in various ways. And people are waking up, and they're waking up to their heritage, and they're waking up to their souls, and they're waking up to knowing that there's other families that they're destined to meet in this lifetime. And 2012 brings us to the pinnacle of recognition. I don't really put any doomsday on 2012 at all. I think that's just poppycock. Some of the things that I see are being touted about 2012, because I think it's the most exciting time to be on the planet.
And that, you read my mind, because it was going to be my next question is how do you feel about 2012, and what do you feel is happening? I mean, do you feel that there is something, whether it is astronomically or just in terms of group consciousness? What do you think is happening that does make 2012 feel like we are on this accelerated path?
It's called all the above. It's almost like, it's like you want to talk about 2012. I think it's called overwhelm. I think disclosure. I think enlightenment. It's like all the nanotechnologies and the bloodlines will be awake, up, operating. Now, some of them will go right off the reservation, Some will just crash and burn. Why? Because it's just too much. Because some of the bloodlines won't mix right. I can see the ETs now going, oops, that one didn't work so well. But all in all, I think that when it gels together, we're going to have a better society. We're going to have a group of souls coming together with consciousness that will find solutions to keep the planet in a pristine condition like it was before technology came and started messing with it. I think that we'll have free energy and that our dependence on oil will be, history for the history books. A lot of things I think will be happening. Most of all, I think that we'll be freer to go about our lives in a way that makes more sense to us. A lot of us now on the planet are, you know, are caught up in religion and politics and things. And after 2012 is finished, I think that we'll all view all those subject matters with a different eye and a different ear for those that can see and for those that can hear. And you said that so well in all your books.
Do you think that there will be more leadership that is open to these kinds of ideas and understandings? I mean, right now, when I look at the leadership in our world, it's very difficult for me not to despair as I watch what's happening in the American electoral year. I have to believe that there's somewhere out there, there are leaders who are forward thinking and who understand this and are a part of this. What do you think about that?
Well, because I've been tracking walk-ins for a long time, and a couple of years ago, we had millions of walk-ins come from the Pleiades to this planet, and they've been stationed all over the planet, and little by little, they're making changes, and we're going to see world leaders that will have walk-in energies with them. They've either been replaced already, or they have assistance. And although it's looking one way right now, it's probably really another. Because we have a lot of walk-ins that came and went through the bloodlines of the Cabal and the Illuminati, and they're going to change it from the inside out. Nobody said what this was going to look like.
Wow. Well, it is a fascinating time to be alive, I will say that. And every day brings something new. And 2012 already has been tumultuous. Exciting, but also distressing. It's very clear that there's a lot of changes going on. What would be your final word to those people who are dealing with the turmoil? A lot of people, all they're feeling is the turmoil. They know that there's something good coming of it. They know that there is change that is ultimately going to be good for everybody. But a lot of people I'm hearing from right now, in my life, on Facebook, out in public, are saying, but there's so much turmoil, there's so much chaos. What advice would you give to those people who know they're a part of something bigger and better to get through those challenging periods?
Well, I'd say buckle up, Buttercup, because you just need to stay in alignment and stay out of judgment, stay out of polarity, be the observer, and don't be the participant. I know that's kind of a harsh thing to say to a lot of people, but it's like, don't engage. If you judge something, it's going to judge you. If you lock into something, you're going to get to play it out. It's like, put yourself in an observation tone. And if it's got your name on it, then go do it. But if it doesn't have your name on it, then, just stay steady. Stay steady. The steadier you are, the more you're out of polarity, the better your life's going to be in the long run. Because if you take time out to have battles with family, with friends, with your coworkers, with mundane activities, you're going to miss some of the highest frequencies that are going to be extended to you because your head will be turned doing something else.
Mm-hmm. You might miss the good stuff. I like Buckle Up Buttercup. I think that might become my catchphrase for the rest of 2012. I think that's going to be my Facebook status tomorrow. Buckle Up Buttercup.
Well, you know what? It is a code. It is Buckle Up Buttercup. Yep. I like it.
And unfortunately, we have to buckle up as well because we have come to an end of another edition of The Spirit Revolution. There is more to come in 2012 for sure, and we will definitely have Lavender on in the future. So if you want to have questions given to Lavender at any moment in time when she comes back, please write to us via the Spirit Revolution website, and that is thespiritrevolution.com. If you want to contact Lavender, by all means, look at starseedhotline.com. If you want to listen to this interview again, any of our other previous interviews, there are a number of ways of doing this. You can go to the website already mentioned, spiritrevolution.com. You can go to Facebook, facebook.com/spiritrevolution. You can download our shows from iTunes by searching either for Kathleen or my name or The Spirit Revolution. And finally, you can also find us on the BBS Radio Archives, where for a small fee, you can not just listen to us, but to all shows which are going out via BBS Radio. But until next time, from the both of us,
the truth against the world. And thank you, Lavendar, for being a real spirit revolutionary.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.